Over at AIPAC, the leaders of the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C., they're constantly proclaiming unrivaled influence on Capitol Hill, and they should be proud. The NRA and AARP's efforts make them look like puppy dogs in comparison to the campaigns of intimidation regularly run by the neoconservatives and Israel firsters against their political enemies. But the Israel lobby does not remain unopposed. At the Council for the National Interest, they put America first, insisting on an end to the empire's unjustified support for Israel's aggression against its neighbors and those whose land it occupies, and pushing back against the lobby's determined campaign in favor of U.S. attacks against Israel's enemies. CNI also does groundbreaking work on the trouble with evangelical Christian Zionism and neocon-engineered Islamophobia and drumming up support for this costly and counterproductive policy. Please help support the efforts of the Council for the National Interest to create a peaceful, pro-American foreign policy. Just go to councilforthenationalinterest.org and click Donate under About Us at the top of the page. And thanks. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. ScottHorton.org is my website. I keep all my interview archives there, more than 2,800 of them now, going back to 2003. You can also follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. And our next guest on the show today is the American hero, Daniel Ellsberg, liberator of the Pentagon Papers, subject of the excellent documentary, The Most Dangerous Man in America, author of the book, Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, which is so important, and you can read chapter one for free online if you just Google around a little bit, all about his first day on the job at the Pentagon in a certain position anyway, the day of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and a very first-person account of what happened there. Incredible stuff. And then he writes all over the place, including for Truth Dig, where he did a great series on nuclear weapons, and he's an anti-war activist of many descriptions and in many very important ways. Courageous whistleblower and defender of courageous whistleblowers, Daniel Ellsberg. Welcome back to the show. Dan, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for such a warm introduction.
Well, I love you. What am I going to do? Play it down? Come on.
Right. Okay. Now it's out in the open. Okay, great.
Okay, good. So let's talk about the American hero, Bradley Manning. He sits on, he's halfway through a military trial right now. I don't know if you want to talk at all about, you know, where we are in the court process so far, or just about Manning in general.
Because of the Snowden revelations here, I haven't kept up as I should have and will shortly on the daily transcripts of that trial, so I'm not up on the very latest stuff on that. Have you been following it closely?
I admit, I've basically been keeping track through Nathan Fuller and have not read the transcripts myself either, but although I could say that it seems as though the government's case is not very strong, and the cross-examination by the defense attorney has been very effective at undermining quite a few of the government's claims and in basically setting up the informant, Adrian Lamo, to admit that there was nothing nefarious here. The kid really meant well. There's just no doubt about it.
Okay, very good. You know, it's the group that I'm associated with on the board, the Freedom of the Press Foundation, that collected money in order for there to be a transcript. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't be, in effect, a secret trial. So the transcripts are there. Now it's up to me to make use of them. So thanks for that summary.
Yeah. Well, and of course, thanks to Bradley Manning, BradleyManning.org, Nathan Fuller, and all those other guys. They're doing great work there attending the trial. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the young woman's name who's done such great work on this.
Alexa O'Brien.
Alexa, exactly. Yeah. That's
what I'm thinking. Was making a transcript earlier, which was all the press had to work with.
Yeah. All right. Now, you know, something really bothered me the other day, and it was one of these TV jerks was interviewing Glenn Greenwald, and he was saying, well, now, so would you make the case then that this Snowden guy is somehow different and better than Bradley Manning, who, after all, is considered a terrible villain by so many people, as though that is the conventional wisdom. That's the consensus that everyone agrees, is that Bradley Manning actually is just a no-good Nick. And even if he did mean well, just think of what a sin it was to indiscriminately dump so many documents. I mean, they don't really have anything. That's the best that they have on them, I guess. But they want us to all just really cheer for the state in its crusade against this young man. What's your position on all that, Dan?
Lee, you know, you don't see many national security whistleblowers who were identified to the public. Most leakers from classified material are anonymous and stay anonymous. So it's really a very small set of people whose names are known at all. And when they stick their heads up, when they do make themselves known or become known, the media on the whole shows a very, puzzling willingness or determination to join the government in deprecating them, and helping smear them in many ways and focusing on their personal foibles or their sexual life, whatever. This happened certainly with me, not so much on the sex. It so happens that Pat Buchanan in the White House reached the conclusion that publicizing what they knew about my sex life would, quote, only increase his numbers. I was a bachelor at the time. So they chose not to, to use any of that. But the and they don't seem to have anything on Snowden. But, for example, I noticed, having just seen this, I would say, terrible film, We Steal Secrets by Alex Gibney, rather incomprehensible why he made such a, what I would call a bad film. But I noticed that no mention was made of, there was ample time given to the charges that were made that Manning and Assange, not before Manning's name was known, but that the source and Assange and WikiLeaks might have blood on their hands or did have blood on their hands. No mention made of the fact that the Pentagon has repeatedly announced that they have no evidence of any blood resulting from these revelations, which is kind of relevant to those charges. It's, you know, the fact is that there was a problematic aspect, I would say. I don't call it a fact, it's subjective here. But there was a problematic aspect, even in my view, initially, about Manning putting out a lot of material that he hadn't read. That has a bad ring to it. How can he know whether it's damaging or not? But, you know, 3 years later, I've seen a lot of benefit come out from the cables that might well not have been, that he might not have read, and it might well not have been published by any one source like the New York Times. For example, the corruption in Tunisia, which led to Arab Spring, really, which led to the downfall of Ben Ali in Tunisia, led to the violent uprising against Mubarak. It's not at all clear that that would have come out if he had limited himself to the relatively small fraction that he could have read. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, no damage whatever. I think we have to, I've changed my opinion on that, in other words.
Well, you know,
discriminate between what he did put out, which was only, and I say this in his terms and mine, only secret. It was not top secret. It was not communications intelligence, to both of which he had access. Almost no one seems to realize that his daily work involved communications intelligence, higher than top secret, and top secret material, none of which he put out. So whether he should have or not, he was very discriminating in what he put out, just as I was and just as Snowden is.
Right.
I don't know anyone who's made that simple point.
Right. Well, you know, he has. In his guilty plea to the facts on the lesser charges,
held it out,
not that
finally in court when he made his statement. And I believe, right, that, by the way, that to hear from him make a statement like that, showing what he had put out and what he had not put out, was one of his reasons for making that guilty plea. It was not part of a bargain. It was puzzling to a lot of lawyers why you'd plead guilty to 10 out of 22 charges without any kind of plea bargain, without getting anything back. But I think one of the reasons was to make that point, that he had selected what he had put out and felt that the material was only secret, not even LIMDIS, NODIS, XDIS, those are distributional restrictions that are put on things, that he presumed that at most it would be embarrassing, that would not hurt security. That judgment seems to have been vindicated after 3 years, no evidence of damage. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, I think his other reason was to say very clearly he had not been induced to do this by WikiLeaks. The idea of a conspiracy there on the part of WikiLeaks was simply invalid, and he wanted to say that under oath as clearly as he could, just as I did when I submitted to arrest. I took public acknowledgement of all the facts that I had done, all the actions that I had done, so that I could say I did this on my own. I didn't tell anyone who might otherwise be suspected of helping me. They had no part in it. And that didn't relieve them of all suspicion, but it helped, I'm sure. At least that's what I wanted to do. And Snowden has done the same. Snowden has taken advantage of revealing himself to say that his partner, his girlfriend in Hawaii, did not know anything of what he was doing, try to relieve the pressure on her and on his family.
Right. Okay, well, we're going to get back to him here in a few. But let me ask you this. I've been making the case, and I guess I'm basically cribbing from Kevin Zeese, the lawyer, on this, that Manning's mistreatment at Quantico, his being held for 3 years before his court-martial was even begun, and the fact that the president, I mean, this to me is just the icing on the cake, even more than the abuse in prison, I think. The president, the Secretary of Defense, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the three highest-ranking people in the military chain of command, all have pronounced Manning guilty. And it seems to me that any honest judge would have to admit that that is a direct order to his judge to convict. And how else is she to possibly interpret that? And so he must be set free, Dan. But then again, I don't know. Am I going, off the reservation here? What do you think?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. He should be free on both counts, just as my charges were dropped when it was revealed that the Nixon's White House had taken steps against me that were criminal and impeachable, actually, and figured in his impeachment proceedings. And as the judge put it, offends a sense of justice. Well, of course, Manning's treatment has offended a sense of justice. But when you say must be set free, well, that position has been raised. All of that has been raised. And the court, the judge decided that on the basis of his being held under conditions that the UN rapporteur for torture regarded as at least cruel, inhumane treatment and possibly torture. As a result of that, they would take 112 days off of his sentence, which might be a life sentence. So I suppose, you know, he gets 3 months off when he's in terminal conditions of some kind. But meanwhile, the treatment of him and the pronouncements by everybody here, like I'm talking about Snowden now, have convinced Snowden, and I think very realistically, that if he wanted to be able to tell the public what he had done and why he had done it and what his motives were and what the patterns of criminality were in the material that he was releasing, it had to be outside the United States. Otherwise, he would be in perhaps the same cell that Bradley Manning was, and that's a military cell. The NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, permits military custody indefinitely of an American citizen who's a civilian. And Snowden could very well find himself at Quantico, naked perhaps, like Bradley was for a while, and have no ability, be really incommunicado, as Bradley has been for 3 years, with the single exception of being allowed to make a statement when he pled guilty to 20 charges, or what was it, 10 charges, I think. And that's the only chance he had to speak out. So I think Snowden has learned from that example. When it comes to being pronounced guilty, the head of the Intelligence Committee here, Senator Dianne Feinstein, has said this was an act of treason, indicating that she has probably never read the definition of treason in the Constitution, in her Constitution, in our Constitution, which involves the element of adhering to an enemy of the United States, which no one is claiming that Snowden has done or that Manning has done. He's not going to be charged with treason, as a matter of fact. But the word can be used as a smear, and, of course, the effect of that on a potential jury is very significant. Of course, the word is being used very commonly about him and Manning, and me, for that matter, by Cheney and others that you'd expect it from.
Right. Okay, and now one more thing before we get too far into the Snowden thing, back to Manning here. And this is something that we've discussed in the past, but I think it's so important to get on the record, especially here in the middle of his military court-martial and everything. And that was the final straw that made him do this, as he explained to the informant Adrian Lamo, was that he had been ordered not just to look at pieces of paper or watch videos and review war crimes committed by others. He had been ordered to participate in them. He had been ordered to help the Iraqi government imprison, capture, abduct people for the crime of writing op-ed pieces, wondering specifically where did the money go about corruption in downtown Baghdad.
And people he knew would be tortured by the people we were turning them over to.
Right.
So not only was the action of turning them over to torturers illegal, criminal, but so was the order to not to investigate it further, which is what he was asking for, not to stop the process, but to continue to get more people to hand over, more suspects. As he put it, summed it up, I was actively participating in something I was totally against. And the challenge he makes to every person really on the planet, and every American citizen, everybody in the armed services or the government, but all of us really, do we feel that what is happening, being done in our name and within our tax dollars, is something that is legal, moral, ethical, something that we should be doing, prudent? Or are you one of those like me who finds it reckless, immoral, and in many cases criminal? The question then is, what do you do about it? And Manning put his life on the line. I think it was appropriate. The stakes justified that kind of personal risk, and the same is true of Snowden. These stakes, we're coming back to him, I guess, but I'm saying the stakes, as they were for me, were worth a person's life.
Right. I mean, this is the thing, and we've talked about this for years before anybody ever heard of Manning or Snowden. Obviously, you've been talking about this since before I was born, but you've been talking about this with me since 2004 or 5, something like that. And that is that when we're talking about these imperial wars of occupation, of aggressive war and invasion in other people's countries, that the soldiers have a duty to liberate this information and publish it and make sure that the Post or the Times or Greenwald or somebody or Julian Assange or somebody can get their hands on, because the mission is wrong. What they're doing is wrong. The empire is wrong.
Orders are expected to give the benefit of the doubt to an order that it's legal that they get, and they certainly do that. And that's understandable in a military context in particular, and really pretty much everybody in government. But a lot of orders that have come down in my lifetime and in the last 10 years and before that are blatantly illegal, blatantly unconstitutional. The orders to torture, to hand over people for torture, to fail to investigate that, are blatantly illegal. And everybody obeyed that except Bradley Manning that we know of. If somebody else has refused any of those things, actually, there have been actually, I would say, one or two people who have exposed it. So let me take that back. Joe Darby, of course, who had to go under a witness protection system for a while here, having exposed the torture at Abu Ghraib. Sam Provance, likewise, was demoted and threatened with court-martial for doing that. So there have been a few people who spoke out. General Taguba, actually, his career was ended when he asserted that what we were doing was blatantly illegal, and that ended his career. So the punishment is clear enough, but the stakes actually make that worthwhile. What are you here on Earth for? What is your life for, and what is it worth? For what will you risk and sacrifice? And really, if people ask themselves that, they should be able to think of a number of things. But but giving up their career in order to save the Constitution or to save tens, hundreds of thousands of people from death in wrongful wars or needless wars would seem to be, it should be one of those things. It doesn't seem, people just don't ask themselves the question. I think if more people ask the question posed by Manning or Snowden of what they ought to do in this situation, they wouldn't all do it, but some of them would.
Right. I mean, I think of it about, you know, in terms of, and I don't know what the prison sentence really is, but would you rather have a couple of years patrolling in Afghanistan, helping the Delta Force do night raids, and maybe getting your legs blown off by a landmine when you got no business there in the first place, or do a few years in the brig for doing the right thing and telling the people the truth, you know? Which is more courageous?
Manning was in a base that I just saw in the movie that was described as perhaps the safest in Iraq. It was far from any, there had been no enemy action, whatever. So he wasn't exactly risking his limbs there, and he's not risking just a few years, of course. He's risking his life.
Well,
but you're right, though. Most people do not have information that poses them with that kind of risk, and they don't take any risk at all. That seems to be the normal, ordinary thing. I think that's a human characteristic and one reason that we're on our way, in my belief, to extinction with the threat of nuclear winter, nuclear war still with us, and the climate changes that are confronting us and the population. And I think a species that has so much capability for destruction, for damage, and so constrained an ability to care about people outside our own group, ourselves, our family, our team, our organization, or our nation. It's very clear, by the way, that Manning, in very particularly, was concerned about the non-Americans who were being harmed by all this. And that's, in a way, what people like Cheney and others mean when they say treason. To care at all about what we're doing to other people is, in their minds, a form of treason. And unfortunately, too many people share that, but some people have awakened. And unless more wake up from that, to that kind of concern, we've had it. The species is going to go and take an awful lot of other species with it.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, it's in the dark times that, you know, there's always, you find the silver lining too, right? For example, you've got this guy Snowden who certainly must have heard your call at some point. You know what I mean? He's not ignorant of Dan Ellsberg, this guy.
He said he admired Ellsberg and Manning.
There you go.
I was very glad to be in that company, but that sounded as though, unlike Manning, he was probably too young to have heard my name at all. And Assange, who was born the week I was eluding the FBI, actually, back in 1971, though he heard about it from his mother, his anti-war mother. But I was glad to hear that probably the example had not deterred him, because both of us, of course, were put on trial for facing a life sentence, Manning and I. Manning is very likely to get it. I lucked out in many ways in that the crimes against me came out in time to spare me that life sentence. But Snowden was not deterred from that. And frankly, that was something of a surprise to me. I was just reading a book here, This Machine Killed Secrets, by Andy Greenberg, which mentioned at the end of one chapter, well, there, given this digital era, there will be more Bradley Mannings. And having just read that, I have to admit, I said to myself, yeah, don't hold your breath. When people see what's happened to Manning, people aren't going to rush to join him. And it didn't take long for Snowden to come along and expose himself to exactly the same risk as Manning. That gives me hope, more hope than I've had for a long time, that there will be others who show that kind of civil courage, on which I keep saying, and it may sound like hyperbole, but in my mind it's not.
Well, you know,
civil courage on which our species' survival depends.
Well, you got to be pleased by some of these polls have, you know, give or take, I know they come back with different numbers, but give or take, half the country says that this Snowden guy obviously is siding with them against their government, right?
Yes,
they don't believe for a minute
Holcomb
that their government is them.
I am encouraged by that. And by the way, just minutes before this call, here's what's easy to do now these days. I just signed a digital petition that Barbara Lee has put out for repealing the authorization for the use of military force, that was signed without you know, any, but just by reflex, by everyone but her, Barbara Lee of Oakland, back in 2001, yeah. Mm-hmm. And she wants to repeal that, since it's been used, as she says, to support torture, kidnapping, drone assassination, other invasions and whatnot ever since. She says it's time to cut that back. So there's a CredoAction.com, I think it is, petition, or Barbara Lee, to support her bill to repeal that. But your point on the, in general, on the polls, there is an encouraging side to that. And I'll tell you something kind of funny in a way. People have drawn attention to the fact that whereas the overall polling on this has not changed on whether you believe in the government having all the data on the telephone calls of everyone, and I would say that includes the content as well, though that hasn't been admitted yet. What do you think about that? The polls are about the same as they were back when that was first revealed in 2005 by the New York Times. But the position, the relative position of Democrats and Republicans has reversed almost in terms of the numbers, the relative proportion. Back in 2005, most Democrats opposed that under Bush. And now, and most Republicans supported it. Now, most Republicans oppose this right now, and most Democrats support it. So they reverse. Well, that looks on the first glance like simple partisan hypocrisy. But there's another way to see it. In a way, they're both right. The Republicans correctly distrust those powers in the hands of a president that isn't of their own party. And they're right. And the Democrats don't trust these powers. They can see room for abuse when it's a president of the other party, the Republicans. Both right. Their only mistake is they're willing to trust it if it's in the hands of a president of their own party.
Right.
They're wrong. And it's a naivete that doesn't do them credit. But maybe they can wake up from that delusion.
Right. Well, you know, I think that's still the margin, right? That's the swing voters in the middle. There's still a lot of people who hate this no matter who's in charge.
That's true. Yes, that is true.
And I'm just having a good day today, I guess. I'm more optimistic than usual. I'm sounding like it anyway.
Yeah. Well, I hate to tell you, but there are also those people who trust that whoever's in charge.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Sorry to tell you that, but... No, actually, I am hopeful at the reaction to this, but we'll see how long it lasts. The administration, I'm sure, is counting on it going away. Even Frank Rich was predicting that this was an interest of the moment, but it'll be over by August. Well, it's up to us to see, in a way, whether we keep this one burning or not. I think there's going to be a lot more revelations by Snowden, and that'll keep it going, I think, given that he's not in the country.
Right. I mean, according to Greenwald, he's got a dozen more stories coming, minimum. So.
That's right. My strong guess is that what we're going to learn is that the recording of data, the storing of data, is not at all limited to, quote, metadata or to foreigners with PRISM or anything like that. I think they're what I would call collecting, that is recording, listening, recording and storing everything. What we're saying right now, of course, but, for example, William Binney, formerly of NSA for over 30 years, says the million square foot a place they're building in Barktail, Utah, NSA is building, he's made some real calculations as to what that's meant to store. And he said if all they were storing was text, for example, or metadata, a small room would suffice for virtually the whole world with the storage capability they have now. He said when you want 100,000 square feet, 10% of that million square feet they're doing, he said, that's clearly for video and audio, and that means everything. And when the president says, we're not listening to your calls, he speaks with forked tongue there, because what he means is we're not listening live, obviously. It would take the whole population to be doing that. But he's not saying we're not storing it for later listening at our leisure with our feet up in front of the fire, pouring over whatever we want to
right.
of what you have. And I think when Keith Alexander and Hayden and these other people involved assure us that they're not collecting. Oh, who was it? It was Clapper. Clapper said, we're not collecting information on millions of Americans, which at first sounds like a simple lie. In the face of what Snowden has revealed there, they are collecting data on hundreds of millions of Americans. But he explains, well, by collecting, I don't mean just recording it. Collecting to me is when you pull up the file and you analyze it and you transcribe it, you know, and something that happens later.
Yeah.
Well, as he said, it was the least untruthful answer he could give to the question, are you collecting data on hundreds of millions of Americans? A less untruthful answer would have been, he said no. And a less untruthful answer would have been, yes. But that's the point I'm making here. I think they are still conning us into believing that the content of our emails and our phone calls and our chat logs and our everything else is inaccessible to them, or they're not recording it. They're not keeping it. I think that's simply false. They have everything.
Right. Well, you know, I think the part of that that sounds the most fantastic is that they could keep all the audio from all the phone calls, that kind of thing. But I was talking this over with James Bamford, and you know, telephone, regular landline, copper landline, telephone, that's only 14K, which is very low quality, really. It's good enough for the human voice, but you couldn't listen to a symphony orchestra over it, right? It doesn't sound very good, really. But it sure is enough, and they could probably, you know, with all the different audio codecs in the world, they could probably zip down the average telephone call to nothing almost. You know what I mean? And then they can, you know, as you said, the storage space required, they've got it.
To assure that the best quality recording of all the symphonic music in the world will be in Barkdale, Utah, so that I hope it's deep, deep underground, so that after the nuclear winter, you know, whoever succeeds us will have access to, you know, really good acoustics.
Let me ask you this. I could go back and read the book again, but I got Dan Ellsberg on the phone. Did McNamara lie to LBJ about what happened, the second so-called Gulf of Tonkin attack mistake, or did they both lie together?
Why do you ask? I'm interested.
Well, one of our favorite reporters tells me his interpretation is that McNamara got the message that you got, that, oops, sorry, we were listening to our own propeller, but that McNamara fooled LBJ into and basically didn't update him that, oops, it was all a mistake.
Well, that is the conclusion of Gareth Porter.
That's my friend, our friend I'm citing there, yeah. Now I'm asking you.
In his book, and frankly, I was very resistant to that interpretation, having lived through the events. It just sounded hardly possible to me, partly because I thought, well, I read the cable that said, hold everything, you know, every previous report is in error, in question here, of the reports of torpedoes that were coming through. So I said, if I read that, how could the president not know it? And then, as he showed me the detail of what we now know of the president's phone calls between the Pentagon, where I was, and the White House, there's no actual indication that McNamara, who did have that cable along with me, did pass that information on to the president. And I was very struck by how careful his analysis was there. And it did look possible that, as he put it, that the president did really want to be absolutely sure that there had been an attack, and that McNamara was willing to go with a much lower level of evidence. In fact, there was no attack, so the evidence they had was wrong, and as in the case of the WMDs in Iraq. But wrong or right, there was a certain degree of alleged evidence. Certainly both of them, well, again, I don't know whether the president was fully aware here. Certainly McNamara did lie to the public when he said the evidence was unequivocal, just as when Rumsfeld said that the evidence of WMDs, we know where they are, here's where they are, these are facts, and when Powell said the same. That was a clear-cut lie that the evidence was strong and unequivocal. And, you know, on the very face of it, it was extremely weak and very equivocal. That was true in both cases. Mm-hmm. So they certainly did lie. The president, I have to acknowledge now, may or may not have known, in which case McNamara really did have a lot more to bear on his conscience than I realized. which is perhaps why he absolutely refused to discuss Vietnam for some 30 years, and eventually did write. He said, we were wrong, but about the war, in his book In Retrospect. But I was told by the publisher of that book that they had to force those words out of him. He was not willing to sign that. This is a little piece of inside gossip here, that Peter Osnos, his publisher, told me that they had told him they would not publish the book unless he was willing to say those words. And so he did, which is to his credit that he finally did. He was the only person who said that out of the administration. And we were all wrong, and that we includes me.
Well, and LBJ, he was looking for an excuse anyway, right? He didn't have to escalate that war, even if McNamara did fool him.
I assumed he was expecting to expand the war, yes, definitely. But he was a skeptic on the bombing. That is one of the things that that brought me around in a way to Gareth Porter's point of view on Tonkin Gulf eventually. That McNamara was openly pushing for the bombing. I knew that. I was never been clear why. McNamara and LBJ was saying, according to my boss who had come back from meetings from the White House, LBJ would say, you're bombing bullshit. And LBJ was properly skeptical on the bombing. The bombing was a crazy idea, basically. I think that McNamara thought the bombing would get us into negotiations in which we'd be able to make a deal, which was unrealistic. But that's why I wanted. Of course, the military wanted the bombing because they wanted a much bigger program of the bombing. So they wanted a foot in the door, which was all that LBJ gave them at first. But LBJ was not anxious to do the bombing. What he was anxious to do, though, was not to lose the war, and he was ready to put troops in, which McNamara was realistically resistant to. So the president was pushing for troops. McNamara was pushing for bombing. They compromised on both.
Right.
And, of course,
instead of doing neither, they did both. Yeah, exactly. This is the same way it always works. That's called bipartisanship. Oh, well.
I think that Obama was likewise very resistant to putting a surge into Afghanistan, the last 30 to 40,000 troops, but he did it. In other words, he could see that it wasn't going to accomplish anything. All of his personal military advisors told him that, but he did not want to get into a fight with Petraeus and McChrystal in the midst of his health insurance program. And so he sent 30,000 more troops to kill and die in Afghanistan. That's the way it goes. And that's the kind of secrecy and the obvious need for secrecy, the fact that his advice was not to do it, had to be kept secret. Advice from people other than Petraeus and McChrystal.
Yeah,
and,
you know, wait, I just want to interrupt you for...
whose position was, give the generals whatever they want. So that kind of internal controversy is the biggest secret, because it raises questions as to whether this policy is really wise or necessary. And all presidents prefer the public to think, I had no choice. Don't blame me. There really was no alternative. All of my advisors agreed that I had to do this and so forth. The fact that that's false is one of the greatest secrets, and that's the reason we need whistleblowers. It's not properly classified, but it is classified, and that secrecy is kept to the death. Mm-hmm. So tenaciously. So the only way we ever learn is when some future president decides that it's in his favor to give the leak to somebody. It so happens that Bob Woodward did come out with all those top secrets eventually, having apparently been given a green light by Obama to show that he really hadn't wanted to do this, but it was the military made him do it.
Right. I was going to say, because it sounded at first as though just the language you used, it sounded almost as though you were speculating, but I just wanted to point out that the publisher, Rothkopp of foreignpolicy.com, wrote an article just like that about how it was all about domestic politics and he knew better. And there's a book, Little America, that was serialized in the Washington Post that says that he specifically refused to read a CIA report that he already knew said, don't bother surging because it's not going to work. And then there's one of Holbrooke's guys who talked all about how the political hacks in the White House ran the entire Afghan policy and the only policy was to just prolong the status quo forever and not actually work at doing anything. Just surge, but surge just to prolong.
Look, that sounds, of course, it is in line with my own understanding of it, but I didn't know any of those references, and I'm very interested in them. So after the program, could I ask you to send me links or references?
Sure, and I guess now I got to read Bob Woodward, which I didn't want to do, Dan. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, well, whatever. But no, the particular ones you just mentioned all sounded very interesting. I'll add one to that. Well, by the way, Holbrooke's dying words, literally dying words, his last words, were said in one story to be, I don't have it exactly, something to the effect, get out of Afghanistan. But that's quite possible because I knew Holbrooke when he was a young Foreign Service officer, one of the few who spoke Vietnamese, in Vietnam. And he had been all over Vietnam. He knew the score very well. I was certain that he had to perceive Afghanistan in exactly the same terms. The conditions, there were differences. The language we didn't speak was, you know, different from Vietnam. The terrain was different. The temperature was different. But the crucial aspects of it were so similar in terms of a hopeless war that I knew that Holbrooke had to see that. He couldn't have forgotten that. Well, When Obama's War comes out by Bob Woodward, he quotes, not directly, but from somebody else, he quotes Holbrooke as saying of the surge, he says he was the most pessimistic, three words, it can't work. And he was Obama's, in principle, his top man, his plenipotentiary on Iraq and Afghanistan. So, Holbrooke, of course, doesn't tell the public that ever, doesn't come out and say, because he's the president's man. He's an insider. He doesn't tell us that I've given the president my opinion that this can't work. And he wasn't the only one. Nearly everybody inside said that, even Rahm Emanuel and definitely Biden, for example. Everybody but Hillary and Gates, actually, who were for it. So we don't hear that. I'll tell you one other thing. Holbrooke, knowing Vietnam as well as he did and having worked on the Pentagon Papers, was the one person that I went to try to persuade to make a united front, not to put out the papers, but to come out publicly and from within the government and say the war is hopeless. We've got to end it. We've got to make a negotiating deal here of various kinds. And I did present that to him. And he was at that point in the Peace Corps. He, because of his disillusionment with the war, he had left the ranks of the Foreign Service officers in there and was working in the Peace Corps in Morocco. And he knew what I was saying, and we saw eye to eye on the war, exactly. And he just clearly wasn't ready to do anything like that, make any public statement, take any public stand, because he wanted to be the president's plenipotentiary on Iraq, Afghanistan someday. And you cannot come out against your president's policy even and get a job even under another president. You won't be trusted to keep your mouth shut no matter what, no matter how disastrous the course is. That's the test of being reliable, faithful, trustworthy, namely, you may criticize inside, but you won't tell an outsider like Congress or the press or the public that we're lying or that we're in a hopeless situation, no matter what it is. And I keep coming back to the point, even if nuclear war is at risk, as it wasn't in that particular case.
Right. But, and, you know, I got to say, that's one of the most important lessons that I remember out of your memoir, Vietnam Secrets, it's called, that really stuck with me is the psychology of being an insider and just waiting and hoping if I can influence my boss a little and he can influence his boss a little. And after all those little people out there, as you say, including Congress, they don't have the top secret access. They don't know what we know. So we don't have any reason to listen to any outside open source type wisdom because none of those people have anything like the access we have. So it's up to us wise people on the inside to stay on the inside and do our very best. And you can really, as you're saying, you could actually have the extinction of mankind in a thermonuclear war based on that kind of bureaucratic psychology of we're the insiders, we know better, blah, blah, blah. Just because they're bureaucrats, just executive branch bureaucrats makes them the kings of the universe.
Well, and you know, just and maybe I'll make this my last thought, if I may. Coming back to Manning and Snowden, and actually I was the same on this point. Snowden is called arrogant, for example, because he took it on himself to put out this information. And even the president makes that point. Well, Snowden explicitly makes a very point. I'm an ordinary guy, he says. I'm an ordinary guy. I'm an American. I'm not a traitor or a hero. I'm an American. I'm just another guy sitting at a desk reading this stuff. Obviously, Manning did not have grandiose notions of himself. He was tormented in his personal life. But each of them looked at this and said, here I have this information, and the public doesn't. Why should I, sitting at this desk, know all this stuff with these clearances that the public needs to know and senators need to know, and senators don't have it? And by the way, we know that because a number of senators have been saying since Snowden's revelation, I've learned more in the last 10 days than in the last 10 years of what NSA is doing. So the idea that, oh, we knew all this stuff that Snowden is, there's nothing unusual here. Hurry on, folks. Keep moving. There's nothing to see here. Is one point. And then on the other point, a little contradictorily, they say super top secret, higher than top secret. The latter is really true. They haven't been putting this out. And Snowden was saying, I don't think it's right that I can sit at this desk and task the system to get the emails and the entire record and all the details of anybody in the country, from the president on down. He said, it's not only a question of my knowing it and the other people not knowing it. My being able to do this and to know this is not right. And there's 1,000 people like me who can do this, and that's not a right. He said, that's not a country I want to live in. And Manning the same, saying, he says to Adrian Lamo, this kind of information, horrible, he says, criminal. He said, should it just be sitting in a safe here somewhere in a dusty safe, or should it be out for the people to know? And, of course, I felt the same back with the Pentagon Papers. Why should I at the Rand Corporation have this history when literally the Senate cannot get it? So, you know, that's not the way it should be. And it turns out that when you make that perception of yourself, that you have the capability to tell a truth that will help save some lives or preserve our democracy. And you don't have to be in the government to have that feeling. Think of all the people who, over the generations, have contributed to cancer of hundreds of millions in the tobacco industry and never told about it. Or asbestos, or Vioxx, or all the other things that are, you know, that are going on. And the people in the government who knew about global warming and were sat on and muffled and so forth. It isn't that unusual to know a truth that would be of great benefit to some other people, that is to say, would save them from torment or in terms of illness or keep us free. Things like that, if you're willing to take a risk of your own life, of your own personal life. If more people, you're not going to get a lot of people willing to do it, but if you have more than we've had who follow like Snowden or Manning, on a lesser scale, perhaps, that we would be a lot safer and a lot freer than we are on the way to becoming.
Thank you very much for your time today, Dan. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott, for the opportunity.
Everybody, that is the great Daniel Ellsberg, liberator of the Pentagon Papers, author of Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. And his website, of course, is Ellsberg.net. I might have forgot to mention that at the beginning, Ellsberg.net. You can read Chapter 1 of Secrets, all about his big day, first day on the job in this new position at the Pentagon, the day of the Gulf of Tonkin non-attack, second so-called attack there. And follow him on Twitter. That's it for the show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you tomorrow here, 11 to 1 Texas time. ScottHorton.org and NoAgendaStream.com.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Every month, Plumline Individualist editor Sheldon Richmond brings you important news and opinions on policy by heroic FFF President Jacob Hornberger, hard-hitting journalist columnist James Bovard, and others from the best of the libertarian movement. The Future of Freedom tackles the most important issues facing our country, from the bankrupt and insane welfare and regulatory states, to foreign wars and empire, the dismal state of our economy, and ongoing assaults on civil liberties. This society needs peace and freedom for prosperity to prevail. Subscribe to the Future of Freedom in print for just $25 a year, or online for $15 a year, at fff.org/subscribe. And hurry up! Because this summer they'll be running my articles about the wars in Libya, Syria, and Somalia and the future of freedom too. That's fff.org/subscribe for the future of freedom. And tell them Scott sent you.
Oh man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner.
Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. There for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey guys, I got his laptop.
Hey y'all, Scott here. First of all, thanks to the show's sponsors and donors who make it possible for me to do this. Secondly, I need more sponsors and more donors if the show is to continue. ScottHorton.org/donate has all the links to use PayPal, Give.org, Google Wallet, WePay.com, and even Bitcoins to make a donation in any amount. You can also sign up for monthly donations of small and medium-sized amounts through PayPal and Give.org. Again, that's ScottHorton.org/donate for all the links. To advertise on the site or the show, email me, scott@scotthorton.org. And thanks. Admit it. Our public debate has been reduced to reading each other's bumper stickers. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. I made up most of them and most of those when I was mad as hell about something. So if you hate war, empire, central banking, cops, Republicans, Democrats, gun grabbers, and status of all stripes, go to LibertyStickers.com and there's a good chance you'll find just what you need for the back of your truck. Own a bookstore? Sell guns at the show? Get the wholesaler's deal. Buy any 100 stickers and they drop down in price to $1 a piece. You can spread the contempt and make a little money too. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.